Welcome to The Jewish Diasporist, a podcast exploring the political, social, and cultural implications of life in diaspora. We are your hosts, Zach
and Ben. For this episode, we interviewed Emmanuel Ovadia, founder and editor of Gazoz de Framboise, a Ladino-inspired quarterly zine from Miami that covers a diverse array of topics, including anti-Zionist politics, which often are not discussed within Sephardi and, for lack of a better word, Mizrahi spaces. Our conversation with Emmanuel provides an overview of the history of Ladino, which weaves from Spain to the Eastern Mediterranean and across the Americas.
Diasporism encourages us to embrace the heterogeneity of Jewish culture, and to paraphrase the Zapatistas, to build a Jewish world in which many Jewishnesses fit. Jewishnesses? Jewishnesses fit. There are obvious comparisons that can be made regarding the roles of Ladino in Yiddish, the most prominent diasporic languages of the Sephardi and Ashkenazi worlds. I did make an effort, however, to avoid making constant comparisons to Yiddish throughout this conversation and to let Ladino stand on its own, as a medium for communication and cultural exchange, with all the political implications that they may imply. Having myself co-created a zine not too long ago, I was interested in speaking to Emmanuel about the actual process of making Gazoz. Where do you start? What challenges do you face? Does it get any easier with the following issues? How do I get my mum to read it? Emmanuel was able to answer some of these questions. In all seriousness, we hope that the work of Gazoz will inspire those of you considering starting your own zines and publications to get on with it.
Like many other short-form publications, zines can be printed and distributed through decentralized networks, thinking about activist kind of work. All issues of Gazoz de Framboise are available online in both digital formats and printable formats, and you can find these in a link tree attached to their Instagram that we've also put into the show description. But before we get into this conversation, we want to remind you that aside from our passion, we continue to produce this show because of our audience scattered across the world. If you like what we're doing here and aren't already, please follow us on Instagram at the Jewish Diasporist Pod, subscribe to our shared YouTube channel, the Hamotzi Network, and consider making a monthly contribution through our Patreon. All of these links are in the description.
We hope that you not only enjoy this conversation, but share it with everyone you know, regardless of whether they're interested. Enjoy.
We are beautiful people, though our hearts are broken. We sing.
Emmanuel, it's really good to sit down with you. It's really interesting seeing the work you're doing, and we really haven't gotten to explore Ladino culture, especially in the current iteration and this current moment on this podcast yet, so we're really excited to have you here. To get us started, could you tell us a little bit about yourself, your family background, and what really brought you to start this zine that is really celebrating and reviving, I don't know if reviving is the right word, but celebrating and carrying forward the Ladino language tradition?
Definitely. So first, Stamug Gadesiro, to be here. I really appreciate it. This zine started almost a year ago, and the vision was for me to bring together different parts of my family's roots and histories in collaboration with a political and kind of artistic production. So my family comes from Damascus, Kurdistan. We have roots in Eastern Europe, in Istanbul. And this wasn't really recognized or appreciated in my family growing up. I came from an Israeli household where diaspora is very stigmatized and where Sephardi culture is kind of subsumed into Israeliness. And so part of the mission of this zine is to uplift those roots and also support other people in doing the same and trying to especially draw out the political connections and thoughts that learning and going through these histories can generate. And then another part of the story is that I live in Miami on Tequesta, Miccosukee, Seminole, and Colusa land. And I want to make sure as well that the zine is reflecting and acknowledging the geographic place that it's being created in. And so also trying to see where we can bring in Florida, Miami, and kind of the Caribbean worlds that we see here too.
You have the great honor of being the first guest of our podcast that is based in Florida. What exactly is Ladino? I assume that most of the people listening to us have heard of Ladino before, but how would you explain Ladino in its simplest forms? I'm not asking, you know, specifically whether it's like fits the standards of any particular linguist and all the nuances on that, but what is it? How would you get that conversation off the ground?
Yes, so Ladino, also known as Judesmo, is a language that was developed by Jewish communities that were expelled from Spain. It carries over a lot of the features of medieval Spanish, developed independently of modern varieties of Spanish. And it, like many other Jewish vernaculars, integrates a lot of Hebrew and Aramaic vocabulary. What's a bit more unique about Ladino, from my understanding, is that it also has a lot of Italian and French across its dialects. And then It is very distinguished based on the communities that speak it. So it's mostly an Eastern Mediterranean language, historically. Major centers in Thessaloniki, in Monastir, in Izmir, Istanbul, Jerusalem. And each of these communities have a different relationship with vocabulary and pronunciation. So you might see more influences from Greek, more influences from Turkish or Arabic.
I've always found that sort of reality of Ladino really interesting and also, I think, commonly misunderstood because so many people hear Ladino. I mean, growing up, the only song we'd ever do in Ladino was like Ocho Candelicas on Hanukkah, which pretty much just sounded like Spanish. And I think I had this assumption like, oh, this is just Judeo-Spanish. And it was only later when I learned that actually Ladino as Ladino actually consolidated in the Ottoman Empire, as you said, from the Jews that were expelled from Spain and welcomed into the Ottoman Empire. And I thought that really shows a certain diasporist quality to Ladino, where it's not really just Judeo-Spanish, but as you were saying, it pulls these words, and I don't know if there's more than just words, maybe even more like grammar structures or something, from the relationship to these other languages that were being spoken in proximity with Ladino. Does that have any relevance to your context in Florida? Because I know Spanish is a very widely spoken language in Florida. Is there any sense of kinship between these languages and communities, or what does that look like?
Yeah, and I definitely agree that what I think is so beautiful about Ladino is its reflection of the kind of Ottoman communities that welcomed Sephardi Jews and that those Jewish people interacted with. Here in Miami, in Spanish is kind of the first language for most people here. If I walk around my neighborhood, people speak to me in Spanish first. And there is a small community of Ladino speakers here, mostly elderly folks in Miami Beach area and some in the Palm Beaches. And often, if I start speaking to people in Ladino, what happens more often is I confuse Ladino for Spanish when I'm buying something from the grocery store. I'll usually get a look that people maybe think that I'm learning a language or maybe even speaking something different. Because mostly I'd say it's fairly, in my experience, mutually intelligible. But there are some words and there are some choices and pronunciation especially that will give a lot of the Spanish speakers here like a questioning glance. What I hope to do through the zine, though, is use that, like you mentioned, kinship between Ladino and Spanish as a way to encourage more ties politically and culturally between the Jewish communities and Southwest Asian North African communities in Florida and then the Spanish-speaking communities here, which historically, especially in New York and Chicago, was a big part of Ladino-speaking activity, was building these bridges with people who spoke Spanish.
So one thing that's going to come up again and again, I think, in this discussion and deserves to be addressed right on, is the similarities that exist, at least in the basic understanding between Ladino and Yiddish. And we've only been speaking for a few minutes, but two of them are quite relevant already. One is the question of consolidation of the language outside of the area from which it comes. Now, Western Yiddish doesn't exist anymore, really, as a spoken language, but Eastern Yiddish developed from Jewish communities that left or expelled or were massacred in the Rhineland and arrived in Eastern Europe. Second thing that you've mentioned is the question of intelligibility. I think that there's very interesting things that you can do with Yiddish specifically in German-speaking countries or where, in German-speaking countries when you're engaging with people, Jews, non-Jews, who know the Hebrew alphabet. But I think that it would also be just a reductionist, like, and quite Ashkenormative perspective. And that's something that, given that majority of the Jewish communities in diaspora, at least, are Ashkenazi, is kind of a problem that we're going to keep having to run into. But where we don't want to just reduce Ladino to being like, oh, it's like Yiddish, but for Sephardim. But what are the differences? I mean, one of the differences that is interesting and that I note, and probably comes for you as well, is that while Yiddish in a secular setting still exists, but obviously nowhere near to the level that it was before the Second World War. But nevertheless, Yiddish maintains a fairly solid base of regular speakers in strictly Orthodox communities. That's not necessarily the case with Ladino. So that presents a certain challenge when it comes to level of institutionality and worrying about whether the language is reduced to just academia or culture and such. So how does that come across in what you see? And in the same way that people are Yiddishists without necessarily speaking Yiddish, but speaking about promoting it and the culture and so on, are there also Ladinists who consider themselves as maybe not necessarily coming from a Ladino-speaking background, at least not immediately in their family history, but who see it as their mission and challenge to support it? Would you consider yourself a Ladinist, or is this a label that doesn't resonate with you so much?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think the term that I would maybe use is Ladino hablante, which means Ladino speaker. There are a lot of different terms, and based off of actually a lot of internet groups that meet to type and speak and read in Ladino. And so you have, named after these groups, Ladinadores and Ladineros. All of these are kind of putting at the center the term Ladino, which, as I mentioned a little earlier, isn't the only way to refer to the language. And I think that the maybe multiplicity of Ladino, I don't know enough about Yiddish and I don't want to flatten Yiddish, but I think the multiplicity of Ladino and the different communities that spoke it make that kind of activism and advocacy for Ladino a bit more difficult. You mentioned earlier Ocho Candelicas. It's a great song, but it also is in a Balkan dialect of Ladino. And so when you're promoting Ocho Candelicas,
oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, there are some words there that if you've never spoken Ladino before, you might think that that's how all Ladineros or Ladino Hablantes speak it, which is completely fine. I think we need to be very encouraging about having that multiplicity of dialects and pronunciation. But it does mean there's sometimes a little bit of worrying over what version to use. Institutionally, Ladino has a decent number of sources to pull from, not nearly as many as the Yiddishist world, unfortunately, but there are a lot of groups that are trying to promote Ladino speaking and learning. There's a lot of courses that people can take for free and at cost. And there are some groups and institutions that are trying to standardize Ladino or offer a standardization, mostly through Aki Yerushalayim, which is a twice or three times a year completely Ladino publication based in Jerusalem. And they set forth orthographic guidelines, for instance. The Sephardic Brotherhood of America, even though they don't do as much Ladino publishing, does often create sources for doing rituals in Ladino. And there are a lot of different internet communities, like I mentioned, that do speaking. There's Encuentros de El Had, which does weekly Sunday conversations in Ladino with like a guest, kind of like webinar style. And so there is an institutional landscape, but it's not as large, and I don't think it has the same richness politically as the Yiddish space.
So what you say about Yiddish dialects, of course, that it is actually something that comes up a lot, because a lot of the standardized secular YIVO or the YIVO institution Yiddish comes from mainly Litvish, Lithuanian Yiddish, while a lot of Hasidic communities use more southern Polish or Hungarian or southeastern dialects. So when we talk about, you know, the political landscape, that's also quite interesting, because language is just a medium, right, in of itself. Like any text or any meaning can be theoretically at least translated into any language, right? Language, it's like a form of art, right? Graffiti can represent either this thing or that, right? But the implications of using a certain language, what in practice comes from using such a language, the current status of institutions, the historical legacies, all of that results in a certain politics of language and use in various different contexts. And so I like to say that, you know, having a Yiddish space isn't inherently political, but demanding government subsidies and funds for Yiddish to be taught in schools, at least for it to be a right for kids to learn Yiddish, for courses to be financially accessible, these are all political decisions that have certain policy guidelines that can be created from them. And so before we maybe move on directly to what that looks like for Ladino today, and I promise this is the last time I'm mentioning Yiddish in this Ladino-centric conversation, what politics do you envisage within Ladino institutional or maybe even like speaker's world? What legacy do you draw on? And then we can move on towards discussing what that looks like from a creative standpoint for you with Gazos.
So as you rightly point out, language is a medium and we can assign different political meanings to language over time. And the choices that we make about how we institutionalize or fund language are very political. I think that there needs to be a political discussion about Ladino because politics is part of the reason that there are much fewer speakers than there were. Obviously, the Holocaust was a huge loss of Ladino speakers, but also Israeli society and Zionism through its pressure against Jewish language diversity, which affected all Jewish languages, also, I think, crushed Ladino speaking. And in Turkey, there were many Sephardi Ladino speaking Jews who articulated in Ladino that they should give up Ladino and they should be speaking Turkish to reflect the state. And so I think in order to advocate for Ladino and to speak it more, we also need to recognize that the choices that have led to Ladino becoming a more endangered language are very much rooted in politics. What I find very inspiring about the history of Ladino publishing and written material we have in Ladino is the wide diversity of political thought. So nowadays, it's very hard to find anything politically articulated in Ladino compared to, I think, other languages generally. In the early 20th century, 100 years ago, politics were expressed constantly by Ladino speakers in the press, in the Ottoman Empire, and in the United States. I'm inspired by this very strong socialist tradition of Ladino newspapers and anti-Zionist or maybe what I would call like non-Zionist positions that are expressed in Ladino press and also Southwest Asian, North African Jewish articles in the regional press. Arab Jews, Ladino-speaking Jews were always a part of the society they were in through the local press and through these community press, using the languages that they spoke and the languages that their neighbors spoke to discuss really important political issues, including Palestine, including Zionism, as well as more internal issues. And nowadays, I feel that a lot of the mainstream Sephardic institutions try to be apolitical, which I don't think you can really be, but or they're firmly Zionist. And to me, it's such a flattening of this dynamic political world we had. And so while what I do in my work is explicitly anti-Zionist, I really do want to just see more diversity and just kind of opening these gates for who is allowed to speak and who's allowed to articulate their ideas in a Jewish language.
There's also, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just curious because you brought up Arab Jews here. And from my understanding, like, yes, when I grew up, I remember hearing, oh, there's two types of Jews. There's Ashkenazi Jews who are white. And there are Sephardi Jews who are not white and are basically North African, Middle Eastern, whatever. And with that, I think I'm highlighting this like very common conflation of Sephardic and I'm going to use the term Mizrahi, even though it's an inherently problematic term. But here you're also saying that there's Arab Jews that spoke Ladino. And I'm curious if that was solely from proximity of Sephardi immigrants in these countries relating with their Arab Jewish neighbors, or like what was the relationship between Ladino and Sephardic speakers in the regions that were also home to Judeo-Arabic speakers and Arab Jews who were not Sephardic?
Yes. So in some cases, it was quite hostile and aggressive. This is kind of the case, and I'm simplifying, but in North Africa, where the Spanish-speaking Jewish people who came to North Africa following the Inquisition, who came to Morocco particularly, displaced politically like indigenous Jews in Morocco. Mm-hmm. And even to today, there are a lot of, I've met at least in my personal experience, some Moroccan Jews who distinguish between these groups going onwards, the Jews who speak Spanish and the Jews who speak Arabic or Darja or an Amazigh language. In mm-hmm. Jerusalem, from the research I've done, it seems to be a bit more of Ladino kind of becoming a lingua franca for Jewish communities. But the relationship between the Sephardi Jews, who were actually descendants of the people who left Spain, and then the Jewish population in Southwest Asia, North Africa, who were there before that time, and then maybe adopted Sephardi liturgically, but have different relationships, is really complex and needs to be studied more and discussed more, because there are real differences between those communities. Nowadays, people will use Sephardi and Mizrahi, which is also a term I don't like, to distinguish between these, but that's not the origin of the term Mizrahi. Mizrahi only recently has kind of fulfilled that role of trying to say non-Sephardi Jews who are in Africa and Asia. But that's newer.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of erases some of the problematic aspects of Mizrahi. On the whole, I think that we can look at Jerusalem to really see where there is a relationship between Arab Jews who don't have a Sephardi history and then Ladino-speaking Jews who came in, and learn a bit about what their relationship was. I think there's more research I want to do on that. I know that there is some discussion about that in the Ladino press in the United States, where Ladino-speaking Jews are trying to distinguish themselves from the Arab Sephardim. I think there's a lot more to kind of dig in there. And I think it also really depends on which kind of part of the Ladino-speaking world we're talking about.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I asked this question, but it's kind of inherently problematic because it's so diverse. I mean, if you're talking about Sephardi diaspora who came all across the Eastern Mediterranean, Southern Mediterranean, then like, yeah, of course, it's going to be different in different places. But thank you for, I think it's an interesting question, especially given this common conflation of like Sephardi means not white, means not Ashkenazi. But of course, I really think it's important to think about internal diversity within the Jewish community. And I'm so curious how that might have looked in a place like Damascus, where you have ancestry, where there were Sephardi Jews and Arab Jews cohabiting. And I wonder if they shared synagogues at all, or if there was a sharp divide between the community. But of course, that needs some serious research to really elucidate more clearly.
I will recommend to listeners the book, I think it's called The Last Jews of Kerala by Edna Fernandez, which looks into the very, very interesting divides between the Malabar Jews in this little part of southwestern India and the Sephardi Jews that came later on, because there's a lot of the Sephardi Jews being referred to as the white Jews and the Malabar Jews being referred to as the black Jews, and there being very strict segregation between them until the early 20th century, and interesting divides and what we describe today as racial understanding of society. That's further on east in India, and it's important to think of also a lot of these areas of, we think of the Mediterranean basis as being the space of interaction between Sephardi and, well, what we can call Mizrahi, as we've all understood why a single label that just means like Eastern Oriental is problematic, but we're using this just for the purposes of other Jewish communities in Southwest Asia and North Africa. But there's also a lot of interactions that go on in India, in the rest of, you know, the South Asian subcontinent, in Singapore, in Hong Kong, and so on. But something that you mentioned earlier, Emmanuel, is also something that I would like to bring back our attention to for a moment. I have written not too long ago about this question of what is the role of these apolitical institutions when it comes to the perspective of Jewish leftists engaging with them, specifically in the Yiddish context, although I think that a lot of it might be similar to what might be seen with other Jewish languages, which is that in a landscape in which there is already relatively little, to not say extremely little, attention and resources that are brought to these languages, the fact that someone is working on something, even if it is not explicitly supportive of the same values as we share, is already a plus. And this is kind of mirroring the approach that the Bund had in interwar Poland, which is that it supported young Yiddish writers in its publications on the condition that the work that they did was not actively opposed to the values of the Bund. It didn't have to like check a list from like some sort of Stalinist cultural policy, but as long as it wasn't against, that's good enough for us, right? So there's value in institutions like that existing. However, it's also worth engaging with them. And maybe there are people that will be attracted to apolitical institutions that might see with our participation there that, hey, there's also these guys, they're doing this other cool thing. Maybe that will be interesting. There's also the value of there being explicitly, you know, political institutions that push and work in certain ways that maybe even folks in apolitical institutions would like to do, but they know that they can't due to various constraints that they might have And so we arrive to one of the main topics that we wanted to talk about, which is an explicitly leftist Ladino Hablante or Ladinero publication that you've been working on. So could you tell us a little bit about, well, first of all, where does the name come from and how did you come up with the idea? And then I'll also want to nerd out a little bit because I myself have also produced a political Jewish leftist zine on my own. So I'd like to maybe share notes, no pun intended, on how that process looks like for you.
Yes, so let's talk about Gazelles de Framboise. The idea is a free quarterly raspberry-themed Ladino-inspired zine in Miami. If you can believe it, that's the only one we have here, unfortunately. And the name I chose partly because I think it's adorable, and also because it kind of acts for me as like a really interesting metaphor about my family's personal history and then the kind of roots and stories and histories that I'm pulling from in the zine. Gazelles de Framboise literally just means raspberry gazelles or maybe raspberry soda. Gazelles is a Turkish word that comes from French and refers to a type of soft drink in Turkey.
Oh, gazeuz. Okay, I get it now. Sorry, from French. Right, okay.
Yes, exactly.
Got Boom. It.
Yes, and Ladino does that too. We steal a lot of French. So it's a Turkish soft drink that has roots in the Ottoman culinary tradition, as well as European colonialism and technology. And if you read anything about technology in the Ottoman context, there are constant debates in the Ottoman press about the role of technology in European sciences and all that. So on its own, I think it's a very powerful symbol and metaphor. And then the raspberry flavor. So raspberries are very important to Ashkenazi herbalism. They have medicinal properties. And because of that, I would argue you have actually a lot of beverages and treats in Israeli society that are raspberry flavored. And so the fact that you could go to a supermarket in Palestine and pick up off the shelf raspberry syrup and put it in sparkling water and call it gazelles, to me, is a very interesting metaphor for the ways that the Ashkenazi history through colonization and through colonization through non-Jewish Europeans as well became intertwined with Ottoman history and culture and then Palestinian and general Arab geography. And so all that together kind of touches on all the different places that I'm trying to draw history from, that I'm trying to pull out different perspectives that I think are salient for today.
One of the zines that I was looking through, which it's incredible that they're all available online easily, beautifully. It's really wonderful to be able to have that. And we're definitely going to be putting the link to at least the link tree, if not all of them, within the show notes, because I really think it's something that deserves to be looked at. But you said something basically about how it's like this intersection of like European colonialism, Ottoman culture and cuisine, as well as this, I forget what the third one you mentioned there, but it's just
transnational histories.
Transnational histories, exactly. And I think that's sort of really encompasses a lot. And I think bring in the Ashkenazi herbalism aspect of thinking about specifically why raspberry, alongside, I mean, seeing Zach's face when he realized, oh, this is a French word. I know French. I can understand. It really speaks to just, I mean, it just feels so diasporous in like a very concrete sense of there's all these different forces, some of which we might find like culturally rich, some of which we might find oppressive. But at the end of the day, it's deeply human. And that's really what you're focusing on, this human aspect. And I was really curious when I first learned about Gazelles de Framboise, how do you approach this question of Ladino inspiration? And I will say, looking through it, there's actually more Ladino in the zines than I thought there would be, because it seems like this isn't a language that all Jews speak. This isn't even a language that I'd say a sizable percentage of Jews speak today. How do you approach this Ladino inspiration while also like holding the fact that not a lot of people speak this, but it's also something that you want to celebrate and engage with culturally? How do you hold that balance?
Yeah, so I think that from the beginning, it was important for me that Ladino would be the language used for titles, headings, things like that. I didn't have the skills, and I'm still working on them, to create full pieces in Ladino. There's some things, and there's like a poem in Ladino.
Yeah, there's poems, which is beautiful.
Thank you. But I really want to assert that Ladino and that language, particularly in its Hebrew writing system, is preserved and brought to the forefront. I try to mitigate it by making the rest of the text accessible in English. And then I always like to have the Latin spelling of a Ladino heading or title particularly for me, this is to reach a Spanish-speaking audience. I've had a lot of Spanish-speaking friends. It's definitely like not mutually intelligible one-to-one, but I have a lot of Spanish-speaking friends say that when I text them in Ladino, which I often do, they can usually understand what I'm trying to say. So it's through using not just Ladino, but using two different scripts, the Rashi script and then the Latin Roman script, that I'm trying to call attention to people who are familiar with the Hebrew writing system, people who are familiar with Spanish, and then the body being in English to kind of be for just like the general majority.
I want to take a moment to talk about the use of Rashi script within Ladino, because this is one thing that I've seen is pretty common within Ladino publications. But as someone that, like, I teach people to read Hebrew, but I can really barely figure out the Rashi script, especially like the Aleph. Why is the Aleph got to look like that? Why is the Mem got to look
so
like
funky.
That? They're so confusing where I'm like, is that a chet or like what? But I'm kind of curious what you know about the history of Yiddish publication and whether it's always been done in the Rashi script, whether it was done in the Latin script. I know like Turkish made that transition in the 20s under
Ben's
Ataturk.
Ashkenormativity.
I'm about the
Ben's
politics.
Ashkenormativity rises through by saying Yiddish instead of Ladino. Oh, we're definitely keeping that in.
Okay. It's still early on the West Coast, okay? But basically, I'm just curious what the politics around what script to use looks like historically and how you kind of fit within that.
This is a great question. I'm so happy you asked it. So Rashi script is the traditional script used for Ladino. And private communications, letters, things like that would be written in Solitreo, which is another script which is used much more rarely because there are fewer people who are able to read it. And there's some really great work being done by Brian Kirshen, who's trying to kind of ensure that Solitreo survives. But nowadays, people usually encounter Ladino in Latin, has been my experience. I think this is a perfectly acceptable choice. You mentioned Ataturk and the Kemalists, and I don't know the specific history there, but I'm pretty sure that they are related in terms intellectually, like modernizing the script by making it in Latin and making it in a Romance writing system, which actually people tried to do with Hebrew as
well. It's also like a Europeanization.
Yes. Oh, 100%. Yes. So you can actually look it up. There's this really interesting journal that was written in Latin in Hebrew, and it's just really funky. But a lot of Ladino journalists were trying to encourage their community to switch because it was seen as being, in the early 20th century, seen as being more modern. As you correctly pointed out, there's a huge link to Eurocentrism there. There are a few more nuances, too, with the type of Hebrew script you're using. So it's not just you're using a Hebrew script, but which one are you using? There is, I think it was La Vara, which is a phenomenal Ladino newspaper published in New York City. I believe, and I might be wrong, it might be a different journal, originally published with Rashi, if not the whole text, parts of the text with Rashi. And then they changed to the Meruba, the block script. And Carlos Jerry Lopez, who's a phenomenal Ladino and linguist and a linguist of many, many other languages, I think he speaks over 10 languages, has explained that separating the Ladino-speaking community from the historic kind of rabbinical leadership by getting rid of Rashi and using the more modern and Zionist Meruba system.
So it made that transition intentionally to break from the rabbinic custom of using Rashi, which comes out of the Sephardi rabbinic tradition.
Yes. And okay. It was very similar to the Latinization of seeing things as modern. There was also something I don't think is central as in the Yiddish world, but there was a lot of opposition to the traditional rabbinic leadership. And if it wasn't quite for secularization, it was trying to disentangle Ladino-speaking communities from rabbinical leadership. So today, I think I most commonly come across Ladino in Latin, and that's because it's much easier for people to read and learn, I think, definitely than Rashi, although you will see people using Hebrew. There are people, like I said, preserving it, but the Latin script I've seen the most is kind of taking over. And then there's different orthographies. So are you going to write your Latin using Turkish characters? Are you going to use French kind of orthography is another option. The Wikipedia pages that are written in Ladino are very messy because they have different fights over which orthographic system they're going to use. But all of these people are really trying to say, you know, the way that we're writing this is important. Who are we trying to reach? What community are we trying to build? And what does this script represent? Does it represent for us religious authority? Does it represent for us historical tradition? Does it represent something modern? I don't think every person who's writing in Ladino is thinking and trying to make that political choice. But a lot of the people historically and today who are advocating and publishing in Ladino are thinking like that.
It seems like one of the challenges then is just to make the Rashi script more accessible. Is there like any work that you know of? And this specifically comes because as an editor of a Ladino publication, is there any work being done on publishing Ladino script and software and a keyboard to help you with that?
Yes. There are on Google, you can download Rashi font, for instance, and you can type in Rashi just using a Hebrew keyboard setup. There are also ones for Solitreo that people have developed. So if you look up Solitreo keyboard, people will be able to download those and actually type in Solitreo, which is interesting because it's a fully cursive script. And then different courses have different orientations to it. So the one that I had studied under was more academic. And so they really wanted people to learn Rashi. And so from the beginning, things were in Rashi. And I'd say 50-50, we had material that was in Rashi in Latin. Other people, I think particularly Liliana Benveniste, who runs Iseferad, I think she, from my understanding, doesn't really use Hebrew writing systems and uses mostly Latin. But there is a lot more, I think, in the last couple of years of people trying to make it accessible digitally. People can definitely find the requisite fonts to type in Ladino the way that people had been doing a century ago. One of the difficulties is only maybe that with Solitreo, since it's a handwriting, you're kind of learning the standard. And if you want to go digging into the archives, it's going to be very difficult to tell if someone's Aleph is the same as yours.
Yeah, I actually had never heard of Solitreo until you brought it up. And it sounds like that is actually the predecessor to modern cursive Hebrew, which is interesting because notoriously, when I have been in the archives, like cursive Yiddish is like one of the most notoriously difficult things to like figure out what it says. And I can only imagine that Solitreo is the same way of finding sources in that where it's like, okay, hopefully this person has good handwriting because otherwise you're never going to be able to know it. Or it's lost to history.
At least consistent. As long as your resh is the same as every other resh, I can probably understand it. If you're changing up, we're going to have a problem. From my understanding, the Hebrew cursive actually came more from the Yiddish system. Mm-hmm. Solitreo, I don't think that there are any influences on Hebrew cursive, but they both have influences on mine because my parents, since they're Israeli, they write in Hebrew cursive, and then I'll write in Solitreo cursive, and then I'll mix them together when I'm writing in Ladino, and no one can tell what I'm writing.
So we've got a pretty basic understanding of what inspired you to start this work and this publication. The name I really like. I got distracted for part of what you're saying just because I was imagining drinking some very nice gazos de framboise, of raspberry soda. Really tasty, right? So starting the publication is one thing. Getting issue number one is another thing. How do you commit towards continuing a publication? What is your priority? When is the moment that you decide, you know what, today is the day. Today is the day where the next issue is starting to come out. Do you already have several issues in advance planned out then on what you would like to do? Who do you contact after the first few times? What sort of things do you learn? What practices come in handy that make the process easier?
So we publish every quarter. So every season I have a new publication and I try for there to be at least three different pieces in each one, with one being kind of a recurring, you can think of it as like a section or a segment. I usually publish, if I publish seasonally is how I describe it, I publish in the last month that can usually be described as that season, unfortunately, because of how Miami time works. But what I find very useful, and especially for people who are interested in starting their own zine, is to really keep a list of different ideas that you have. And so you can pull from that. And what is especially useful is to have that available when there's a current event that happens that magnifies the importance of an idea that you maybe stored a while ago and didn't know how to use. That's come in handy quite recently, about a year ago now, where there was a shooting in Miami Beach that was very relevant to kind of the discrimination of Arab Jews in Israel. And I was able to kind of pull from that in order to write a piece about it.
Wasn't that the shooting where a American Jew and a Zionist shot two Israelis because he thought they were Palestinians?
Yes, he told the police that, allegedly he told the police that he shot two Palestinians. They were Jews. I'm pretty sure that they are Southwest Asian, North African Jews, Mizrahi Jews. It was this manifestation of something that actually happened in Israel with some regularity of shootings of people that the Israeli police or military thought were Palestinians and ended up being Jews. And with regards to getting everything out for the zine, there's so many different steps because I need to make a printable version, then there's a digitized version, making sure the sources are up for the 3-4 people who are nerdy enough to go and check out the sources. The distribution I find the most challenging because it's very easy, I think, for people who are maybe just getting started, especially in the zine world online, to take social media as the main medium for your work. But I think it's so important that we really make sure that our social media is a tool for announcing what's going on, but getting people off the app to do reading. I actually had started several years ago a Instagram account that I've since deleted, but that was supposed to be informational. It was using those carousels, kind of like, so you want to talk about and other accounts of that nature. But I find them to be very, very draining and to kind of stifle conversation in some ways. And I think there's so much to be done if people are conscientious about how they use the internet.
The first thing that comes to mind when I hear of that, or I imagine this format, it's not that it's always like this, but there was a meme a few years ago that said, here's what's happening in the Sudetenland and here's how you can help. But I think what you say about printability and the limitations of each format, because every format has its limitations, right? There is something that comes from print, especially print that is done well. Right. I'm not talking about like an article that goes on a website and that is printed as an A4 sheet. Article that is included as part of a wider collection of pieces that have been thought out in a certain way, that have been placed one before the other, you know, with illustrations that bring the whole thing together. Obviously, not every print publications, even ones that, you know, should be doing this, always do it with as much care. The fact is that we look at our screens too much. If there is every minute that you are looking and reading a book, magazine, a leaflet, a pamphlet, whatever it is a minute that you're not spending looking at a screen and straining your eyes. Well, you still might be straining your eyes, but you get the point.
At least someone's not saying something racist.
Yes.
In the
oh my God, there's
section
no comment section. You just like, you, yes, right? So you know? It's exactly. Hey. There's definitely value, and there's always going to be value with having print issues of anything. That doesn't mean that there aren't advantages that come with online. You know, it's much easier to share. You can always control F if you need to find something quickly. Definitely something that I didn't do during my studies. So I'm very happy that you are doing this process. I'd be keen to hear more about what that distribution looks like. But
yeah, I was just looking at the link tree you have as well, and you actually have all the printable issues on a Google Drive that's available publicly, which I just had the realization of, oh, I could just print some of these and put them out in my synagogue's free books thing. And maybe I'll go do that later today, because might as well have really cool, culturally connected things available to the community. I feel like having more people doing that sort of stuff. I was going to ask, and I was like, I wonder if they're already there. So that's really cool that you make them available, and I hope people are taking advantage of that to put them in places that they should be going to so that they're read by an audience that otherwise wouldn't read this sort of thing. I mean, you don't have your average Zionist Jew going to synagogue who maybe has some cultural connection to Sephardi ancestry or Ladino speaking in their ancestry, but you're not going to get people that aren't already like kind of your target audience going out of their way unless there's something put right in their face and they're like, oh wow, this is a beautiful thing, I might as well look at it. And then, hey, before you know it, you had someone reading content that they wouldn't read otherwise, which you don't really get on the internet. You really only have self-selection in a way that can be echo chambery, unfortunately. Which brings me to my next question. What sort of content, you mentioned poetry, we talked about politics, but what sort of content can people expect to find in Ghazals de Framboise?
So there are kind of three, we can call them maybe genres or styles that I have in there. Every issue, except for the upcoming one, which I'll talk about shortly, includes a book review section called La Meldachona, which means the bookworm. And it is a place for me to kind of amplify a text or some other piece of media that I found really useful for me personally. I try to make sure that my writing is very clear about how what I'm reading is transforming me or impacting myself. And then I try to do a piece that is broadly Southwest Asian, North African related, and then a piece that is connected to Florida or Miami or the US South. So I'm kind of hitting all the parts of the audience and community that I'm trying to create through this scene. So the styles that I experiment with are kind of this like kind of very dry history style that I'm used to writing in, and inserting into it almost like a gonzo journalism where I'm trying to talk about maybe my experience going to a historic site or my experience and how a specific current event transformed me, as well as giving the more academic information and trying to weave those together. The poetry was something new. That was something that I had the honor of doing for the Sephardi Mizrahi Egalitarian Kihila in New York City. And I got permission from them to republish it. And then I'm really trying to expand what this zine provides and offers. And part of that is bringing in other writers and authors. This February, early this February, inshallah, we'll be publishing an issue that will have 5 Swana Jewish artists and poets and writers. And they're going to be in conversation with each other. Like you said earlier, Zach, what's so powerful about having print is you can kind of create implicit connections and conversations between different texts. And they're going to be really beautifully illustrated, kind of inspired by medieval manuscripts and Sephardi ketubot, marriage contracts. And it's also going to include the first Ladino prose that I'll be publishing by a really wonderful writer that blends kind of these kind of themes that we've been talking about in the issue with their understandings of history and Sephardi history. It's super fascinating.
That just sounds like objectively very important to be doing, because I don't know of anywhere else that is creating a space for this sort of culture within the language that isn't just the language for the sake of the language, but is also doing something within the language that I think is objectively so positive within the wider Jewish cultural ecosystem.
I apologize for being a little bit quieter for the last few minutes, or maybe some people would appreciate that. But I was trying to do a whole bit where I was going to print out the zine and then staple it while we're recording, but then I realized I only have single-sided printing. Next time, but that will be done.
Single-sided printing is the bane of my existence,
yes,
unfortunately.
Exactly. What are you shaking your hand for, Ben?
Against the
single-sided
printer.
Oh, I see what you mean. I thought you were like, haha, take this. I have a double-sided printer.
No.
I am saving 50% of my paper.
No.
Another part of what I love about this being a zine and zines in general is, as you mentioned, Ben, inshallah, everyone after hearing this will go and print out an issue and put it somewhere, is that the distribution is dispersed and that people who are motivated by it or who want to change the minds or spread the message have the access to print it out and to share it with people. And so it's not, hopefully not just kind of creating this self-selection that you get through the algorithm.
So thinking about Florida, I've jokingly called Florida the unholy land for many years under the governorship of Ron DeSantis. It's hard to imagine anything but it's also this place that I think, I can't say what percentage, but I would say a decent chunk of American Jews have some family that are probably retired on a beach in Florida.
Yes.
And one thing that I was thinking about when we were talking about this idea of like kinship between Ladino speakers and Spanish speakers in a place like Miami is maybe the dark side of that, which is Miami Spanish speakers are kind of stereotyped on the left as like very right-wing anti-communists who are very pro-Trump. These are like the Cuban emigres, the Venezuelan emigres that basically just want the U.S. to go in and do exactly what they did in Venezuela to Cuba, but across all of the world, basically, to prevent communism or whatever. And it made me think, oh God, there could be like a dark version of this kinship where it's like right-wing Cubans aligning with Ladino Zionists to push a very nationalist-centered worldview. And I was curious how that actually looks like on the ground and if there is like something else as well.
So unfortunately, this does exist. There is a very large Sephardi, Ladino-speaking Cuban Jewish community in Miami. And you can imagine that they're quite an uncomfortable source of some of the reactionary and fascist tendencies we're seeing. But as somebody who's very involved with organizing in Florida, I do want to push back against this idea that everyone here is a fascist and that all of our Spanish-speaking cousins are, you know, the capitalist class that got kicked out. I'm sure, as we all know, there's so much more diversity there. And so much of the organizing down here is led by some really incredible comrades from Venezuela, from Cuba. A big reason why I center so much of the work in Florida is because I see the same potential that you mentioned about this kind of unholy alliance maybe between the anti-communists and the Zionists in Miami, which, and unfortunately, because of how welcoming the South Florida Jewish community has generally been towards Zionism. We've had, as you probably know, Bibi was here recently. We had the Jewish National Fund had their conference here. We have constantly like slews of speakers that the anti-Zionist Jewish community down here is constantly trying to push out and show them that they're really not welcome. And so part of the zine and the work that I want to do in this community isn't just articulating politics in Ladino for that sake, which I think is important in and of itself, but it's also trying to provide a bridge between leftist Spanish speakers and grow maybe some leftist Ladino speakers down here in South Florida. I think that a big part of what the historic press has done is help communities find each other. And I hope that this zine can also kind of be a way to help connect people who otherwise being in, if you grow up in the Sephardi community in South Florida, it can be quite scary to break out of that and to start challenging that. And people should either way, but I hope that this can be kind of a way for people to see that there are other people who have similar ideas and commitments and values and find ways to reach them. And then also see the bridge between their struggles, the authoritarianism that they see in their families, and the authoritarianism and reactionarism that we see in other parts of Florida communities. And so while I would agree that everything that's been happening in Florida has been catastrophic, there are so many people here really fighting because they're aware that we are a center, unfortunately, of fascism. But that means we also have a very unique obligation to fight it and to bring insights about it as well that we have from being here kind of in the front lines, maybe, if you want to think of it, of fascism in the U.S. anyhow.
Yeah, and that's so Deutschkeit-coded, of really like rooting oneself and saying, no, I can't just leave. I actually have an obligation to stay where I am and do what I can to prevent it from spreading. I mean, if fascism takes over the whole world, you can't just run away.
Worst case scenario, if the sea levels rise a bit too much, you'll just sell your house and move.
Well, that's if anyone will buy it, right?
Ben Shapiro joke.
Can't sell it if it's underwater.
Sorry, my host is older than me. My co-host is older than me. just a few things as well. Like, I mean, aside from everything that you mentioned as well, like, it's also worth remembering that Ron DeSantis has had several like incidents of explicitly fascist messaging. We all remember the spinning wheel that was an SS symbol in one of his ads. Also, like in terms of history as well, if we're mentioning it, the last living founder of the Bund died in Miami of the 13 original founders. So the last thing that I wanted to ask about, because you've mentioned a little bit that the mainstream Ladino community, like whether it's right-wing or Zionist in South Florida, I assume that they haven't been too receptive to the work and publication that you've done. But have you had any sort of feedback or reactions from maybe less leftist or less politically minded people who might just appreciate that there is a new Ladino publication on the block, whether it be in North America or in historically Ladino speaking communities in places like Spain or France, in the Balkans, in Turkey, in Israel?
So I've noticed that a decent chunk of the audience who is consistently reading is somewhat international. We do have some people who are Turkish, a decent amount of people who are Arab, which is great, which is the community that I want to reach. I don't think that Gazoz is right now on the radar of like these mainstream institutions, but I have had the very good fortune of finding a lot of support from these smaller, I'd say, projects kind of similar to mine that are also trying to promote Ladino, also have a political vision. There's one account that comes to mind is Echaremos Lashon, which is a carousel style account on Instagram. And they do, you know, just like Ladino vocabulary and connections between Ladino and other languages, but they're also explicitly anti-imperialist. And they've been a huge source of inspiration and support. And so I think at this moment, it's mostly these smaller innovators and advocates, but I really love that community. I think it's really beautiful to be connecting with people who are outside of this kind of mainstream block. And I hope that when the mainstream takes notice that there is that appreciation, that there is some more Ladino cultural production, and especially that there's political intellectual production in Ladino, which there's been relatively less of compared to, you know, obviously Yiddish, but other languages in general too.
Yeah, I mean, just to kind of move towards wrapping up, I mean, we've talked about primarily what you've been doing, but you also mentioned like a Sephardi egalitarian community in New York City that you visited. I guess I'm sort of curious, like, what do you see as the possibilities? Not necessarily like the probabilities, but what do you see as the possibilities for this sort of work going forward? And like, what future do you see the work you're doing as hopefully leading towards?
So this kind of question came up recently on an episode of On the Nose, where they were discussing Sephardi Mizrahi reclamation work. And there was a criticism or a discussion point about how a lot of it is based in certain communities. So there's relatively a lot of Moroccan, but not as much Kurdistan Jewish, right? And so I see this as part of the solution that we just need more. We want to encourage and support people in creating more. And I think what's particularly important for the Swana Jewish community or the Sephardi Mizrahi Jewish community, those aren't the same, but I know those categories are sometimes lumped together, is I really think we need to have more dialogue with non-Jewish people from those communities. I hope that I'm hoping to do actually is to bring together some Miami poets in a future issue this coming year, maybe in the fall. These poets who do have those backgrounds where some of them are Swana Jewish, but some of them are just Swana. And bring those people together in a conversation so we're not maybe replicating an echo chamber of Jewishness where there is, because it's Swana, a lot of multiplicity, but there aren't these efforts to rebuild the same bridges that have been lost in the past century. And so, as you mentioned, the Sephardi Mizrahi Egalitarian Kehila doing incredible work in New York City. There are others that are focused on, liturgy, studying those kinds of elements of the culture. And there are groups that are focused on political advocacy, like Jay Swana Bay, based around San Francisco. And so my hope is that the zine can contribute to putting more Swana Jews and non-Jews in dialogue, providing a space for Swana Jews and non-Jews to speak and to discuss in a political mode, and to hopefully create more of this cultural production and political production, and provide a space for all of these communities that have kind of lost their voice over the past century.
As we finish up, Emmanuel, it's been such a pleasure speaking to you and learning more about Ladino and the work that you and others have been doing on this front. Is there anything else that we or the listeners should know, either about your work or any of the subjects that we've covered that we did not mention yet?
I think I'll really just encourage listeners, who, especially those who are trying to find more ways to kind of embody the cultural or political reclamation, to use kind of the ideas of Ariel Aisha Azoulay, to explore zines. Zines are a great way to do this. They can be very fancy and put together, but because they're zines, you can also make them scrappy. You can steal office supplies from work. You can print at the library. And I think that producing is such a great way to delve into an experiment with these ideas, aside from just kind of reading. And hopefully we'll be having another call for submissions soon. And so if you think that you'd like to show your work, please stay in touch. I'd love to support that too.
Amazing. Also, oh, I forgot what I wanted to say earlier, as Kurdish Jewish perspectives were mentioned. Something also just for people finishing off the program is to really pay attention to what's going on in that part of the world right now. And there's been obviously a lot of attention regarding the protests in Iran and the massive, massive casualties. We do not know, unfortunately, how many exactly have been killed, but we do know that a lot of people have been killed. There's a big regime crackdown happening right now.
Tens of thousands.
So I think it's worth standing with the people who are over there. And we do not hear much about the Iranian Jewish community today, but I do know that there are some people in, especially in, as might be expected, who come from Beverly Hills, doing a lot of work in that aspect culturally, obviously some that is closer to us politically than others, but still worth pointing out. And also about everything going on when it comes to the Kurdish project in Rojava, and also Kurdish Jewish communities that might have any sort of attachment to that little corner of the earth. So we might do, we should do something in that regard.
Yes.
Something also that we've been thinking about a while ago is inviting a Sudanese Jewish author.
I mean, I think at the end of the day, when we talk about diasporism, we're talking about transnationalism. Mm-hmm. We're talking about a world of many, many worlds. And we only have so many voices. And we're so grateful for you, Emmanuel, to help elucidate what Ladino culture and engaged Ladino politics looks like today. And I'm really, really grateful for the work you're doing. And we're going to put all of the links to your Instagram and to your link tree where you can find each of the editions that you've already put out, as well as I love that you have it in both a digital form, which is really nice. It like even lets you turn the page. It even makes a page turning sound. Whoa, when you do it.
It's just like the real thing.
And then you can also download and print the actual printable editions, which again, highly, highly recommend doing that if you have access to a printer and a place that people might be interested in something like that printer. Going by. Please put those out. Double-sided. Curse be the single-sided printers, wasting our paper.
Horrible.
Killing our trees. But we're really, really grateful for you, Emmanuel. All the work you're doing is so important, and I'm really hoping that we can stay in touch and continue doing the work you're doing, because it's so important to have this sort of cultural production, and I'm grateful that we have it in a place like Florida where you'd least expect it.
Definitely. It's a great honor to be here. Merci mucho. Elef todot.
We sing for joy.